You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
The risks surrounding the economic outlook for the euro area remain on the downside, but should have diminished after today's monetary policy decisions and the continued fall in oil prices over recent weeks.
Mario Draghi, president of the European Central Bank, today announced a massive programme of quantitative easing. But is it several years too late? Michael Binion and Robert Fox will discuss this and the day's other main news stories, from ISIS to Ukraine. A little later, we'll take a look at this week's new Italian news weeklies. David Pleasant, what do we have this week?
Well, Steve, we've got two very different, very arresting front covers from Panorama and Espresso, both tackling in their own ways what is the journalistic story of the moment, the aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo attacks.
David, thank you. We'll also review some of the best new book releases with Robert Bound, and we'll hear how Winston Churchill's fascination with science may have helped the Allies win the Second World War. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before all of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news from around the world.
World and top business leaders are meeting for the second day at the World Economic Forum in the Swiss resort of Davos. The meeting comes as the European Central Bank announced a plan to buy government bonds to breathe life into the flagging Eurozone economy and fend off deflation. But the news sent the euro currency to a seven-year low against the British pound and an 11-year low against the dollar. Colin Dyer from the real estate company Jones Lang LaSalle gave an analysis from Davos of the current state of the world economy.
Generally, globally, economies are beginning to recover. Yes, there's been some downgrade in prospective growth rates, but growth rates are still improving, led by the US, which is showing strong, robust growth across the markets. There's lots of demand from corporates for space across all of the sectors. There's lots of equity looking to invest in real estate, because with interest rates in bonds at 1% and 2%, real estate looks attractive, and there's a lot of debt available to help finance those deals.
Meanwhile, Greece's anti-bailout party Syriza has widened its lead over the ruling Conservatives, two surveys showed on Thursday, with just over a day of campaigning left before general election. A poll by Metron Analysis, to be published on Friday, showed Syriza's lead over the New Democracy Party of Prime Minister Antonis Samaras growing to 5.3 points from 4.3 points in a previous survey. Shelling has killed at least 13 people at a bus stop in Donetsk on Thursday, the city's mayor said, as fighting flared across eastern Ukraine. Separatist forces captured 16 wounded soldiers as government forces withdrew from the main terminal at Donetsk airport and then brought the captives to the site of the bus stop shelling, where they were forced to kneel before a crowd of outraged locals. While the US Secretary of State John Kerry expressed his concern at these recent developments.
We're particularly concerned by signs that the Russian-backed separatists are attacking a full-scale initiative against the city of Debaltseve, and in an attempt to obviously gain control of a very significant rail juncture, and that is in blatant violation of the September 19th Minsk Agreement ceasefire.
El Salvador's Congress has pardoned a woman accused of abortion and later sentenced to 30 years in prison for homicide. The vote may signal similar relief for other women who've been convicted and sentenced to jail for abortion, which was criminalized in El Salvador in 1997. Domestic worker Carmen Vasquez had already served 7 years of her sentence prior to the pardon. And Britain's Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond says the coalition fighting Islamic State militants could need up to 2 years to force the militant group from Iraq. A high-level meeting of 21 countries is currently in London to discuss their progress in the battle against Islamic State militants.
What we are doing with this meeting is bringing together the key members of that coalition, those that are most actively engaged in the front line, to take stock of our achievements over the last 4 or 5 months, to hear from General John Allen about what is happening on the ground, and to plan the next steps of this campaign, which we've all recognised will be a long haul.
And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vas à Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's almost 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York City. My guests today are Michael Binion, foreign affairs writer and former diplomatic editor of The Times, and Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard. Robert and Michael, welcome to you both. The European Central Bank announced an ambitious programme of quantitative easing just a few hours ago. The ECB, as we just heard, is going to inject at least 1.1 trillion euros into the eurozone economy. That's around 60 billion euros a month. Mario Draghi said the programme would start in March. The aim is growth, the lack of which has caused huge problems across much of Europe. Michael and Robert, before we hear from you, let's get the reaction from Davos and the World Economic Forum. Here's Matt Campbell, reporter-at-large for Bloomberg News.
I think the reaction on the whole is pretty positive. There is a consensus, perhaps not among everyone, but certainly among many of the business leaders and political figures here, that something like this had to be done to make sure that the eurozone gets nowhere near deflation and gets its economy going again in some fashion. And look, monetary stimulus is one of the obvious ways to do that. So I think people are pleased that this did actually occur. What remains to be seen is the implementation and whether there will be other measures required down the road and if the economies respond to these measures.
That was Matt Campbell, reporter at large for Bloomberg News. Michael Binion, why has it taken quite so long for this step, which many economists said should have really happened years ago?
Well, I think it's all down to Germany, really. They have been the block on this, and they're still not happy about it. I think they've accepted that something had to be done, and quantitative easing, pumping money into the system, is the obvious thing to do. What the Germans are worried about, and have been all along, is that this would actually expose European countries to the debts of the less responsible countries, and they mean in particular Greece and some of the other southern members of the European Union, and that Germany and German taxpayers will have in some way to pay for this, which is not what they want. But on the other hand, Germany has profited a lot from the entire eurozone, and people have put a lot of pressure on them, saying, well, your market has done very well out of it. It is really Germany's responsibility to make sure that an impetus is given to get the markets going again.
Robert Fox, on that point from Michael, Germany often seems to forget, doesn't it, that it has benefited enormously from there being a eurozone, and that there are responsibilities that come with those prizes.
Absolutely right. As Michael was saying, already the voices have appeared from the CDU absolutely opposing this, saying that we'll go along with it because we're consensual, we're good Europeans, but it's not the kind of policy that we favour. And in fact, there has been quite a sharp divergence on this. There is a great deal of concern that in the middle ground that the German strategy actually was beginning to defeat Germany. That things are slowing down, that, okay, it's still a mighty economy with mighty performance, but nothing like as good as it should be and doesn't look good compared with the US and the UK for obvious reasons. I think the timing of this, by the way, is extremely interesting. Why now? It had to happen now. And it had to happen broadly, and I'm not going to give you a laundry list, but for three reasons. A, the momentum, and people were saying Draghi is weak, and this is it was very much he was on his mettle about that. That's the small point, but there is serious concern about deflation now. There was a very seminal piece last week in the New York Times. It's the kind of piece that contributes to policy. It just isn't an editorial by Paul Krugman, saying we are on the lip of going over the edge into deflation and it's going to take a long, long time for Europe to get out of it. That is a warning. And thirdly, of course, the Greek elections on Sunday.
We'll come on to the Greek elections on Sunday in a moment. But first of all, Michael Binion, I'm doing some maths here. 1.1 trillion euros. There's around, you know, 500 million Europeans, let's say. That works out to me as about 2,000 euros per person. Why not just write a cheque to everyone for 2,000 euros? Where's my money?
That's what a lot of people would like, yes. Now, would that actually work? Yes. I mean, some people seriously have said we should simply pay people money to go out and spend it. I mean, this has been...
Well, I mean, essentially, we're doing this a roundabout way by saying, yes. Well, let's give this to the banks and then they can give it to us. Why use the middleman?
Yes. Well, the banks are not actually going to give the money directly to you. You're not going to go along and be able to sort of hand in a slip and be given cash. But it makes the cost of borrowing much, much cheaper. And that's the point. And that's what they want to do, so that people will start getting out loans, starting up businesses or continuing with their businesses and feeling a bit richer to go out and spend money and feel that they then can indulge in the kind of consumerism that in the end is what drives markets.
Let's look, Robert, at this issue of the Greek election. As we're hearing, you know, Syriza are rising in the polls and now a few percentage points ahead. It looks likely, I mean, you know, it's opinion polls, so we don't know for sure, but they may well either form the government or lead a coalition government. Should we really be as scared of Syriza as certain people would have us?
There's a shadow here. I was just discussing this with Michael before coming into the studio, that Syriza has quite an honourable pedigree, and it comes from a party that I used to know as the KUKUS, which was the Communist Party of the Interior, the Euro-communist, very much on the Carrillo-Berlinguer kind of line. And over their main role, by the way, up to and with the end of the Cold War, was really to be critical from within the side. They didn't really, from inside the tent, they didn't really seek power. And I see much of this in the way Syriza has been manoeuvring this time. The leadership has been uber reasonable in the last week of pronouncements. Oh, don't take it red that we're going to leave the euro. We will have to discuss. We'll have to see which way things are going. But, and I think this really strikes a chord, this austerity, German-driven, is, and it's not because it's German-driven, but because it's austerity, is unacceptable. And we cannot have another 3, 4, 5 years of it.
And that's the thing, Michael Binion. It's all very well saying, oh, well, you know, what Syriza are proposing, it could be quite dangerous. But the people that will say that don't exactly have a fantastic track record over the last few years to fall back on and say, well, we've been looking after things and everything's been hunky-dory.
Well, absolutely. When you've got 60% or more of youth unemployment in Greece, I mean, that's a massive amount. Almost any university and school leaver can't find a job. You've got no future there at all. When you've got thousands of businesses going out of business every week, and when you've got people seeing that they simply have no future in Greece, leaving in droves, sending their money abroad, then you begin to think, well, actually, wouldn't Greece actually be better off outside the euro? They're saying they're not going to leave. Of course, the worry is, if they tried to leave the euro, it would be very difficult and very chaotic. It might work in the long term, but not in the short term. And the other thing is, would they have to leave the European Union as well as the euro? Now, that's unclear.
I want to get both your views on this, but Rob, I'll start with you. The debate in terms of the political choices in 2015 and beyond are often described as, well, there are the mainstream parties and then there are the extremists and there are the people like the Podemos or Syriza on the left, or you've got your right-wing populists. Is there not actually something to be said that actually the, you know, these left-wing populists are they're not racist. They're not about bashing immigrants. They've just got a different economic model. And let's face it, the old one hasn't worked very well. Is it a bit unfair to sort of group these two together as, well, they're both extremists?
I think you're right. And I think on some issues, there is obviously a pan-European consensus, both on the left and the right. On other things, there isn't. There is something peculiarly Greek about this. I want to take up what Michael said quite rightly. I've spent a lot of time looking at and being involved in Italy at various levels, and I'm involved in the employment in the public domain for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, a workforce of about 80. And I know the problems that they go through. Now, the levels of unemployment, particularly of young people, in Spain, Italy, Portugal and Greece, this is simply intolerable. And when Michael and I, many years ago, were at university, we would be describing it, and not just from the Marxist historians, as a pre-revolutionary situation. This cannot go on for a decade. And I think this is the criticism. Very good housekeeping by the Merkel coalition and the way she's conducted politics. But she has no plan. She has no strategy for the future. And this is why this is a major European issue, because it is looking like not the sum of the parts, but the parts at the moment of the EU. And it is an existential problem for the EU, because hardly any member is happy with the way that the European Union is operating, and Michael rightly says that it may have to come to that Greece within days is leaving the euro. There is no mechanism, by the way, to leave the euro. And that's why you ask the question, you raise the question of EU membership.
And Michael, on this point, you know, talking about, you know, the levels of unemployment and the level of unrest there's been, the verbal unrest there's been, are you actually surprised that there hasn't been a revolution or an attempted revolution or street protests that have gone beyond what we've seen
in Southern
Europe?
Well, it's difficult to organise a revolution, actually. I mean, it takes quite a lot of planning, and you've got to get on board all the instruments of state. In other words, the armed forces. You've got to get a large number of politicians ready to go along with you. You can't just throw stones on the street and think that that's going to cause a revolution. Young people, I mean, there have been demonstrations, there have been riots, some quite bloody riots.
But I mean, also there haven't been, I mean, perhaps revolution is one step further than anyone's even looking at the moment. But there hasn't even been, you know, lots of protests that have seen a mainstream government fall and replaced by a government that is more in tune with the streets.
Well, indeed, because for quite a number of people, the feeling is, what on earth could we do instead? I mean, you can throw out the government, but most of the mainstream parties in the end decided to go along with the austerity. I mean, most Greeks still don't want to leave the euro. That's the bottom line. 75% want to stay in it. I think if they thought a little bit further, it would be dreadfully painful to leave. But in the end, it might be better.
Robert Fox, you want to add something?
I think that what we're seeing, and your point is absolutely right about, there is very little revolutionary organization, because struggling to be reborn, we're finding ideology. Ideology has, in Michael and my experience working in Europe over the past 20 years, it's very, very interesting, and so much was self-fulfilling about Francis Fukuyama's thesis about the end of history. There was the end, or a pause, in Western Europe at least, of in the old ideological debate. And now you do hear, I mean, Charlie Hebdo, it came up, they talked about France being the land of Rousseau and Voltaire. People are looking at political thinkers again and saying, what does that mean to our society? I think it was hyper-consumer society, and also there's something in the information revolution, which seemed to move away with its sort of onanist tendencies, to move away from ideology. But I do think, and I do detect from friends in Greece and Italy particularly, that ideology is on its way back.
I want to move on now to recent events in eastern Ukraine. Pro-Russian separatists have appeared to have gained ground today at Donetsk Airport, which has been a scene for bitter fighting over the past few months. Michael Binion, you know, the airport isn't going to be used. It's symbolic rather than anything. But what does it say to you that, you know, Ukrainian troops have now withdrawn from the airport's main terminal?
Well, it says two things. First of all, that the cost of staying there is getting higher and higher. And if you send more and more young men to their deaths, that only actually makes any solution more difficult, because it makes it personal for millions of people. It makes it a debt of blood, and therefore it would make any negotiations more difficult. That's one thing. So I think, quite rightly, the Ukrainians felt that simply to sacrifice for a few hundred yards, I mean, it's the sort of futile sacrifice. And the second thing is, it shows that somebody on the other side is supplying the rebels with a great deal of weapons, and that somebody is pretty clearly Russia.
Robert Fox, we're going to move on to ISIS in a moment, but I want to look slightly more broadly here. Do you feel that we in the West have become quite bad at realpolitik, at realising when we should strike deals? You're looking at the situation in Ukraine, you know, wouldn't now be a good opportunity for the West to say, okay, right, let's, it's a stalemate. We're not prepared to put in the troops to help Ukraine. Ukraine can't do this on its own. Let's try and find an agreement. But that means sitting down with Putin and giving him something that we don't want to give up.
I think it's very, very difficult. By the way, I don't think that it has been, paradoxically, it's been weakness on the part of the West. I think that what has taken people by surprise was the complexity of the Eastern European question, which it now is, and it's now a major strategic question for NATO. I mean, this is you can't mess about with it. It's not something, you know, to keep NATO in being. And I think they've been shocked by Putin's manoeuvre about what he's prepared to do. And so now that if you go and look at what, for instance, the UK is preparing in its defence review, it has suddenly decided it must invest in anti-ballistic missile defences, UCAVs, and by that I mean armed drones, and surveillance aircraft. This has changed totally because I think the problem with Ukraine, yes, it would be a good idea to sit down and talk. Well, for goodness sake, they have. They're trying to implement the wretched Minsk agreement,
right now, okay,
which has really blown up, literally, in a horrible way, both in Donetsk airport and in Donetsk itself.
But then on that issue, then if then there can't be a deal, then does that mean that therefore the West has to say, right, well, we will provide more weapons or we will provide more support for Ukraine?
I think the West is preparing its own version again, and it's horrible to think this, of forward defence. We had forward defence on the inner German border. I think that this is where they are. They are very, very worried about the fragile, crapulous, literally flaking apart, corrupted state of Ukraine, which they are so worried about doing business. I've met colleagues and friends who've been in there to negotiate. I mean, they're having such a difficult time even building up the armed forces and the police there, for example. And even Ukrainian citizens recognise how rotten the whole system is. I mean, people like Jonathan Powell, Tony Blair's advisor, are absolutely right. You have to be at a certain maturity before you can have a negotiation. And the situation, unfortunately, we now have to say Russia, not only Ukraine, but the things are going horribly wrong in Chechnya as well. The situation is not mature enough for negotiation.
I just want to briefly bring Michael in before we move on. What then does the West do when faced with this problem in Ukraine? Because, you know, it's tried economic sanctions, and to a certain degree, those have worked in that it's caused some real pain for the Russian economy. But as we've seen today and you know, throughout the last few weeks, it hasn't meant that Russia has stepped back from eastern Ukraine at all.
Not at all. And in fact, what the West has underestimated is the degree to which Russia is willing and able to take punishment. They are very angry about the sanctions. They're not blaming Putin. They're not blaming the Ukraine policy. They're blaming the West. And this means that the more you pile on the sanctions, the more Russia will hurt. The more trade with Russia will collapse, the more the country will become impoverished, but it won't change policy in Ukraine. I think a very strong persistence in the diplomatic route, and Merkel again is trying, Germany is a key player here, is the only way. Plus, some real politik, as Robert said, prepare our defences for a tough response.
Michael Pinion, Robert Fox, we'll leave it there for just a moment. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guests today, Michael Binion and Robert Fox. Foreign ministers from 22 countries have been meeting in London today to discuss ways to fight against the threat of ISIS. In a speech after the talks, US Secretary of State John Kerry announced that coalition airstrikes in Syria and Iraq have been effective. According to him, half of ISIS's leadership have been killed since the strikes began 5 months ago. Robert Fox, can we believe that that's really the case, that this has been, this action has had any effect whatsoever?
They're jolly worried about it. The extraordinary thing is how much they know about how much of the leadership of ISIS and the military leadership they do know a great deal about. But talking to people who are seriously engaged, both at the diplomatic and at the military diplomatic level, they see this as enduring, as very difficult, because of the terrorist attacks in Paris, that they're very worried about it as a magnet still for jihadis, extremists, the displaced from Western Europe in particular, but not exclusively from there. It is not being reduced. And one of the things which British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond underlined was, how do you contain this? You have got to reduce the force and presence of ISIS on the ground. And he was absolutely open. Every diplomat I talked to was absolutely open about it. There is no local indigenous force, Kurd or Arab, likely to defeat the legions, the formation, about 30, 40,000, of ISIS on the ground within 2 or 3 years.
So then, Michael Binion, what happens next?
Well, the West continues with its present strategy. It means continued strikes, airstrikes by the Americans. It means building up the Iraqi army. It means trying to seal...
I mean, building up the Iraqi army? We've been trying that for more than a decade. And
yes,
what comes out of that?
Well, I think there is slightly more motivation. The key issue is to get Sunni involvement in Iraq. The Sunnis have been so alienated that they have been giving soft support to ISIS. And that's how ISIS was able to conquer so much of Western Iraq so quickly. And in fact, the other thing is to cut off the ideological wellsprings. In other words, to try to turn disillusioned young people across the Middle East away from ISIS. Now, that's not so easy, because a lot of people see ISIS as a pretty good, strong outfit. I mean, success breeds respect. People think, yeah, they gave the West a bit of a bloody nose, didn't they? And although people aren't naturally bloodthirsty, I can't say I've seen a lot of worry about these videos of people being executed.
And Robert Fox, if you're Sunni, you may feel that, well, I'm more scared of some of these Shia militias than I would be of ISIS.
I think they're scared of both. But I think, as Michael said, they feel so alienated because they feel that they were deceived with the American surge and Anbar awakening, and we'll pay your militias, and then they cut off the money just before the Americans left Iraq the first time round, and we will get you a place in government, was the promise. Now, that simply hasn't happened. It is not a black and white world. It is so ambiguous, the kinds of supports that you're going to have there. And there are all kinds of things burning and churning there. And one of the things that American leadership seems to be prepared to say, I think we've got to see this through. We've got to pick our friends where we can. And we'd better lay off Mr. Assad, because we cannot afford for him to collapse right now while we've still got this problem of ISIS and other things on our plate. And I was talking to a great friend of mine, for a friend of both of us, Gerald Butt, who is a real expert on these things, looks at Middle East demography. He said, do you realize there are more than 10 million refugees in and around that part of the Middle East now? Now, that is so destabilizing, because 50% of those refugees will never go home anywhere.
On that point, Michael Binion, about Bashar al-Assad, do you think there are people now within Western governments that think, you know what, we made a mistake in calling for him to go? We should have just turned a blind eye to whatever he was doing, because he was secular, he was this guy who held his country together, they would say. We should have just let him carry on.
Well, it's an argument. I don't think that would have been possible, because it wasn't just that he was using troops against people. He was engaging in war crimes against his own people. Chemical weapons, massive bombings of civilian targets. That isn't possible. What I think we should have done is to have engaged with the Russians much earlier and say the Russians have a point. And their point all along was, you get rid of him, what do you replace him with? What would you put in his stead?
Well, this was Russia's point from the very beginning, which was, yes, we are comfortable with our allies. Yes, he's a dictatorship, but he's secular. Who are your allies, the West? Why are you siding with Saudi Arabia? Why are you siding with Qatar? They were very clear about that, weren't they?
They were. And also, I think Saudi Arabia and Qatar themselves didn't quite realise who their friends or who their people on the ground that they were backing were.
I'm afraid we come to leave it there. Michael Binion and Robert Fox, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Right, here's a challenge in the next half hour. Keep up the level. We're going to have Robert Bound here with the latest book releases. I'm sure that'll be good. David Pleasant's also going to be taking us through some new Italian news weeklies, and we'll also be talking about Winston Churchill. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. World and top business leaders are meeting for the second day of the World Economic Forum in the Swiss resort of Davos. The meeting comes as the European Central Bank announced a plan to buy government bonds to breathe life into the flagging Eurozone economy and fend off deflation. Meanwhile, Greece's anti-bailout party Syriza has widened its lead over the ruling Conservatives, two surveys showed today, with just over a day of campaigning left before general election. A recent poll showed Syriza's lead over the Conservatives' New Democracy at up to 5.3%. Shelling has killed at least 13 people at a bus stop in Donetsk on Thursday, the city mayor said, as fighting flared across the eastern part of Ukraine. And a high-level meeting of 21 countries here in London, attended by Britain's Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, who said that the coalition fighting Islamic State militants could need up to 2 years to force the militant group from Iraq. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. Now, David Pleasant is here and he's got the Italian news weeklies in front of him. And David, as you're saying at the beginning of the show, the one story that they're looking at is the attack on the offices of Charlie Hebdo and everything that happened in the aftermath and the reaction across Europe. And we've got two very striking, for different reasons, front covers in front of us. Talk us perhaps through L'Espresso first.
Sure. Where do we start with this cover? They have chosen to publish as their cover an image of the Charlie Hebdo office in the aftermath of the attack. And there's a pool of blood on the there's a wheelie chair and some blood, and it's a messy, very quite arresting image. It takes your breath away quite literally.
It does, because it's also, it looks like any ordinary office. It's, you know, rubbish office furniture. There's a messy desk. There's a couple of water bottles on their side. There's an old coffee cup. And the only thing that makes you realise it's different is this horrible, horrible pool of blood on the floor.
And sort of the colour scheme of Espresso is a blood red, and it's a very striking image. And the title of the issue is Il Prezzo della Libertà, the price of liberty. And the Espresso goes into, and I think that's the beauty with the weeklies. They have time to reflect on what has happened, and so there's some really in-depth reporting, a kind of cultural look at what's happened, a political political look, most importantly as well. So one of the leader opinion pages is pointing to Matteo Salvini, the centre, the Lega Nord's leader. He's a kind of hotshot young leader of the Lega Nord, Northern League, accusing him of seducing the deep right with various comments he's made on the Italian inefficiency and inability to deal with some of the suspects and suspected terrorists that are showing up in Italy, and the various border and visa kind of consequences of that.
So it's interesting. So there you've got Piero Ignazi, who's actually being very, very critical of that. I want to, we'll come back to L'Espresso in a bit, but I want to, it links quite nicely onto the front of Panorama, which on the right, certainly on the right of Italian politics, takes a slightly different view, doesn't it?
Yeah, another striking cover on this same issue, really, that the aftermath of Charlie Hebdo. This goes with the cover of Arrestiamoli, which literally means let's arrest them all, or it could mean let's stop them. And I think we know what they mean, because they've put some bars over the ISIS kind of emblem or flag. This is, I mean, a really, they even themselves call it a special edition. Edizione straordinaria, it's special edition.
And when they say arrest them all, and I guess we should be grateful for small mercies, they don't say kill them all. Are they talking about, you know, Italians that have gone to Syria to fight with ISIS, or are they talking more generally about anyone connected with this? We need to be cracking down, as it were, far harder.
Well, having a look through this, I think that's the kind of issue with the editorial line. I have to say that there are some quite interesting reports, and I think it's probably about time that the Italian press dealt with its Muslim population, which is considerable. But there isn't a distinction there, really, I wouldn't say, and especially from this headline. And it says, special measures for special enemies. It's very ominous tone to the whole publication. We'll go through some of it. So basically, the magazine is calling for special new rules, and it enrolled the help of Italy's best magistrates and intelligence experts to help the reader devise what happens next and how Italy should deal with this threat.
Let's go back to L'Espresso. Aside from that front page and that one column that you mentioned, how else does it deal with these issues that obviously these attacks are thrown up?
Well, what's quite there's a fantastic piece here, maybe about the culture. We'll go past what they have revealed the Interior Ministry's list of 800 terrorists ready to attack Italians. So that's they've also gone for the quite alarmist route in the Espresso, it has to be said. But another piece is about cartoonists and the art of the cartoon in Italy, which is a big part of Italian culture. Here they've decided to publish some of the cartoon by Sergio Staino, who was a friend of Walensky, one of the killed cartoonists. It's probably something I shouldn't read out. It's as inflammatory as you might expect from somebody who worked with the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists. I don't know whether or not the prophet is depicted here or not, but there's different kind of a comic take on a situation between Walensky and...
No, you can say what he says.
He says, "Dear Walensky," this figure that I'm not quite sure who it is, this figure says, "Dear Walensky, Allah is sorry. He invites you to paradise and he offers you 9 virgin girls." Walensky replies, "Let's leave it be, no worries, but I don't have any Viagra, and also I only go for willing girls."
Talk me through some of the other cartoons.
There's some other cartoons, some more. There's kind of the reaction. There's this one, a cartoonist asks what looks like an ISIS terrorist. He's holding a pencil and he says, and the ISIS combatant figure is holding a knife. The cartoonist says, excuse me, do you have a pencil sharpener?
So that is quite funny.
It's a really good piece, and I recommend, I mean, even if you've pidgin Italian, have a look at the Espresso this week.
Okay, excellent. In terms of how, I mean, these stories obviously dominate the magazines this week. Are there any other stories that you think are worth having a little flick at, or is that basically... It's Charlie Hebdo and the aftermath, or nothing.
It does dominate, but there are other stories. One is the long goodbye to President Giorgio Napolitano. Italy's about to go through a huge long process, no doubt, to try and decide on its next president.
He's resigned once again.
He has. I think this is really the definite goodbye. He's in his 90s. Let's hope he doesn't get dragged into another term.
Indeed, there we are. Let's leave it on that. David Pleasant, thank you very much indeed for that review of the Italian Weekly's Panorama and L'Espresso. You're listening to Midori House, still to come. Robert Bound will be here to talk us through the week's best new books. And we'll also be discussing a new exhibition about Winston Churchill and science. There may even be some music too. Stay tuned.
What do you need to build a better city? Tech-savvy urban app builders, hipsters, will take a neglected hood and fill it with quality coffee stores and too many beards. A mayor who's a hard hitter and crack-free, or perhaps some oddballs to liven things up and keep the world a little less well-behaved. On our show, The Urbanist, we've met them all, and many more extraordinary and ordinary people besides, who form the chorus for a good city show.
If all we build is concrete and glass boxes with nothing really cool in between them, it's not as interesting or sustainable or valid a place to live as we're used to. So we got to get back to that thinking.
This one-hour program looks at all the key urban debates, from density to smart cities, but it's not a talking shop for those who think they know best. The Urbanist makes the city human, sees the quirks and contradictions that turn a collection of buildings into a place that people actually want to live. Join us each week on the only show about the cities we live in. It's hosted by me, Andrew Tuck, and it premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours. Join us.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our bureau chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York bureau chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. The cultural and historical significance of science is perhaps easily overlooked, but one exhibition opening at London's Science Museum tomorrow might help to change that. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Winston Churchill's death, and although much is obviously known about the British wartime leader's smoking and drinking habits, it's perhaps less well known that the man had a passion for science. The new show, Churchill Scientists, showcases this intense interest and how many of the technological advances that it spawned played a part in Britain and the Allied forces' World War II victory. Joining me now is Rachel Boone, the exhibition curator for Churchill's Scientists. Rachel, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Talk to us a bit, first of all, about Churchill's passion for science. Where did it come from and how did it manifest itself?
So, as you just mentioned, Churchill is more famous for being a writer or an orator or wartime leader, and maybe not so much about his interest in science. Churchill was always fascinated by science. During the First World War, when he was a soldier, he took the time to read not only about history, but also the scientific books of the time. So looking at Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species. He also read a lot of H.G. Wells and later became friends with him. So he was interested in this combination of the history of science, but also where science might lead us.
And how did that translate into the sort of leader he was, and what impact did that have on science?
So Winston Churchill was the first Prime Minister to have a science advisor constantly at his shoulder in the shape of Frederick Lindemann. And since then, there's always been a chief scientist in government. It's through that relationship and his reading and general interest that he really encouraged science to be used as a tool during the Second World War, encouraging the relationship between military leaders and scientists to work through some of the problems that were being faced. A good example of this is the development of radar, which Churchill later commented was one of the most important things leading to the success in the Second World War.
And how much can that be pinned on Churchill, and how much is that just, this is the environment that he helped create?
I think that's a fair question. It's kind of a mixture. Our exhibition is trying to put a spotlight on Churchill's interests, and we've got some brilliant stories, such as he was probably the first MP to ever learn how to fly, and he took to the air in 1912, only a couple of years after heavier than air flight was actually conquered by the Wright brothers. So he looked at technology as a positive thing. He argued during the Second World War and the post-war period that Britain needed to depend on our brains because we didn't have the massive population and the mass industry, but it was going to be our brains and specifically our scientific knowledge that was going to lead us forward.
And when you were putting this exhibition together, were there things that you discovered that you hadn't known before that made you reassess the way that, you know, you saw Churchill? Because obviously you came at this knowing that there was a story to tell here and that there'd be things to show. But were there things that even then really surprised you?
Yes, so I was one of the curators working on the project, and I was really surprised by how close Churchill really was to Britain's first atomic bomb programme, which was called the Tube Alloys Project. And even nowadays, you probably, when you look at government, you think of all the different groups within it that make those decisions, but Churchill really was there writing good in the margin of reports encouraging Britain to take on a project like the Tube Alloys project.
And do you think there are lessons to be learned looking at this exhibition now, looking back at this time, you know, during the Second World War, that today's leaders, not just in Britain but elsewhere, can look at in terms of, you know, how we view science and how governments encourage science?
I think the Second World War was an incredibly unique time within Britain's 20th century. It created this heightened energy where scientists were removed from their research in universities and given the task to develop radar for aircraft or munitions and working around keeping Britain healthy through rationing and drug development. And it's that unique experience that when war ended and the post-war opened, the scientists went back to their work in labs and universities, but they took with them a new excitement about their subject. They had met the right people. They weren't afraid to ask for more money. So building a collider or a massive telescope seemed possible after that experience. There was lots of equipment left over as well from radar and during the war. So it kind of ignited a new enthusiasm in the scientists when they returned. So that's where that boom in post-war British science occurred.
But it's then quite hard to recreate that sense of urgency right now.
Absolutely.
When you don't have that existential threat.
Absolutely. And I think we should be thankful that we're not facing another world war. But this is a fantastic case study to explore using the Science Museum's collection and also having the chance to borrow some brilliant Churchill artefacts.
Rachel Boone, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We're back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Monocle 24 です.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
Time now for a little bit of music from London, Years and Years with King.
I caught you watching me under the light. Can I be alive? They say it's easy.
That was King by Years and Years here on Midori House. Before we go today, as ever, just enough time for our daily arts review. And today it's books. And our very own culture editor, Robert Bound, is here with three new paperbacks right in front of him. Robert, hello.
Hi, Steve. How's it going?
Very good indeed.
You didn't read that introduction off a piece of paper?
No, no.
Talking of paper.
Ad-libbed it. Worked it all out.
Yeah, I did that. Yeah. That's pretty good. So I want to talk, there's three things here. One
yes.
of them hasn't come out yet. One of them has just come out, and one of them is sort of old, but has just been reissued. Is that kind of, that's the kind of happy medium we want on this kind of review segment of the show?
I'm
right?
very happy with that. One of them I took home last night.
From my desk, I think.
Yeah, I pulled from your desk to home last night. Another one I've bought but haven't read.
Okay.
So I have an interest in all three of these.
Okay, good.
Well, at least two of them anyway.
Well, I'll talk about the one you nicked off me yesterday. Mm. That is Nobody's Ever Missing from a New York novelist called Catherine Lacey. It's published by Granta, and it is the most amazing incendiary, sort of visceral, I suppose, debut novel written in the first person. A woman suddenly turns up hitchhiking in the middle of nowhere in New Zealand. And it turns out she's vanished from her quite nice life, her husband, maybe not so nice, in New York. And it's sort of that you figure out through sort of 180 very, very crammed, very kind of intense first person pages about perhaps why she might have given up this nice New York life to be sort of scrabbling around hitchhiking across New Zealand. And it's an amazing thing. The first person aspect gives it a kind of great sort of sense of strange self-possession and power. So that's a cool one. You will enjoy that.
I'm enjoying it already. I got 20 odd pages in last night, and
so
it was,
you know,
already
what I mean?
Yeah, it's very, there's these sentences that go on and on and on, and you sort of, you're feeling this inner monologue.
Mm.
And also there's just the odd little thing here and there. You go, oh, what's that about?
Yeah, and it's nice. It does that lovely thing, and it's difficult to do this in a first-person book that kind of goes between the past and the present tense, but is always, I did this, I did that. It's difficult to put those bits of exposition into the prose, isn't it? To tell people why you think this and why you think that without having to resort to speech or anything like that. So it's I think that's out at the end of this month. It's published by Granta, and that's going in the March issue of Monocle as well.
Excellent. Okay. Nobody is ever missing Catherine Lacey. Where do you want to go?
Nobody's ever missing Catherine Lacey.
Was there not enough of a pause?
I think you should put by Catherine Lacey. Otherwise, it just makes it look like she's the least loved debut novelist currently working in New York City.
Catherine Lacey, I apologise. I'm sure people are missing you all the time. Yeah. Nobody's Ever Missing by Catherine Lacey, published by Granta. Read the review from Rob in the March issue.
It's a good one. Next, we're going to come to Philip Hook's Breakfast at Sotheby's. It's an A to Z of the art world. That is Philip Hook's subtitle. He's an old school art dealer. He works at Sotheby's for years, at Christie's for a little bit. Then he was a private art dealer, and he's gone back to Sotheby's, I think, in a sort of kind of cozy chairmanish role. And he knocks out fiction. He's also been, I think I'm right in saying, he was nominated for the Bad Sex Award for one of his novels, which he's very proud of.
I think you would be, wouldn't you? If you were nominated for the Bad Sex Awards.
Yeah.
The Bad Sex Awards, we should point out, is not for bad sex.
It's for writing about sex badly. Not for writing about bad sex. The sex might be really good, but you're writing about it badly.
Yes.
Again, Steve, I really don't think you put enough of a pause between... between the verb and the adjective.
I was just trying to point out there wasn't an award for bad sex.
So there he is. And this is a fantastically witty, but he does talk about it. There are, as I said, it's an A to Z of the art world. He goes, you know, under E is eroticism, and he does talk about his award or his nomination for the Bad Sex Award. And it's a really fantastic book. It's very, he's got a very dry, sort of pugnacious way of writing as an art expert. And he basically is writing not for investors. It's a kind of fruity autobiography, really, of his time in the art world and why some things are worth more than others. I mean, working at the big auction houses, it's more about cost than it's about art history, perhaps. And he's very, very witty and dry. And it's an amazing book. I think you can learn a lot. It's one of those books you can get a great window into the art world without knowing much about it.
Brilliant. And then just finally and briefly before we hit the end of the show.
Last year Vintage, to much fanfare, republished three of John Williams's novels. He was a sort of forgotten novelist of mostly the 1950s. He was an academic at the University of Missouri. He wrote Stoner, famously, about the...
The book that was everywhere. You saw, you know, whether you're on the tube, wherever you were, you saw people reading Stoner.
Exactly. It was everywhere. It was in lots of, recommendation tables on bookshops all over the world, I'd have thought. Butcher's Crossing is the second most famous one to be republished by Vintage. I think I might even prefer it to Stoner. It's absolutely amazing. It's a Western. It's a sort of classic Western. It's about a smart boy from Boston that goes west to try and kind of slightly get himself into a bit of trouble. He ends up on a buffalo hunt with this sort of amazing force of nature that is this guy called Miller, and they end up getting up to all sorts of adventures and trouble and all the rest of it. It's a man in a Western on a search for his soul. Does he find it at the end? He certainly gets very cold.
Okay, good. That was the one that I bought but never actually got around to reading. You know, you always have that pile of sort of, oh, that looks interesting, I'll buy that, and then you don't actually quite
I know it well. Well, next stop for you, Butcher's Crossing, Steve.
Okay, Nobody's Ever Missing first.
Oh, yeah.
And then Butcher's Crossing. Robert Bound, thank you very much.
My
indeed.
Pleasure.
And that is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to Michael Binion and Robert Fox. Midori House was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by David Pleasant and Henry Rhys Sheridan. The studio manager was Antonio Fernandes. Next up, after the headlines, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And of course, don't forget, the Monocle Daily is a little later, 2200 hours here in London. That's with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours in London, 1300 hours on the East Coast. My name is Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
uit Londen. Dit is Monaco 24.
Way you London. This is Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe top.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.